Hi, listeners, and welcome to the latest footnote episode of the Fantasy Animation Podcast with me, Chris Holliday.
And me, Alex Sargent.
We are still joined by Pete Kuntz, who is Assistant Professor at the Department of Communication at Tulane. He was our guest when we talked about Beauty and the Beast. We've nabbed him. We've not let him go just yet because we want to probe him to think about the Disney Renaissance. Now, Pete has very kindly written a blog post on the Disney Renaissance. Obviously, he's written a book, Staging a Comeback, about Disney during this period. And the blog post that he wrote for the website begins with, the Disney Renaissance is one of those curious constructs that circulates among the Walt Disney Company and its fan communities. So, with that in mind, the Disney Renaissance, what is the... Alex has got the timer ready. So,
I'm
10
ready.
Minutes. Yep. 10 minutes. What is the Disney Renaissance and why is it a curious construct within the history of Disney?
Well, what the Disney Renaissance is changes depending on who you ask. But I think the most common understanding of it is a period of revitalization at Disney Animation, beginning with The Little Mermaid in 1989 and continuing until Tarzan in 1999, in which Disney produced hit after hit, largely depending on the use of fairy tales, myths, and other stories. And quite often depending on the use of Broadway-style soundtracks and or pop music. And during this period, people believe that animation got itself back on track. It's a troubling notion because, as scholars of literature will tell us, whenever you call something a renaissance, you actually end up creating three things simultaneously. You create a classical period, then you create a period of dormancy, anti-activity, intellectual stagnancy. And then, of course, you create this moment where it all came back. So for me, it's a curious construct. One, because it largely comes from Disney itself. Michael Eisner starts using the word renaissance as early as 1986, 1987. It's troubling because it's gone largely unquestioned by our colleagues in film studies. And it's troubling because it dismisses the work of animators during this period of alleged fallow creativity. And I think many folks, myself included, and I imagine my present company, can point to films during this period that they love and think are brilliant narratively and artistically. And yet, to call a certain period a renaissance and a certain period a dark ages really, I think, is dismissive and too broad and generalistic to be tenable. Periods are always artificial constructs in terms of doing history, right? History is more complicated than that.
We were having a conversation off air before we started recording this, Pete, and we were talking about kind of, the analogy with the Renaissance. And there's a lot of discussion amongst medievalists about whether that term just needs to, whether the real good work would be to get rid of that term. But I think most people in that world would say that the term is useful, but what it tends to be useful for is more to talk about what's happening in that period rather than anything about what came before it, right? So your three-part structure was really useful because basically what it asks us to ask questions of what is it about that classical period that people in this quote-unquote Renaissance period are looking back to? Why are they trying to position themselves as emulating that period? And what 1980s reasons are there to want to make the 1940s and 50s in Disney animation particularly classical? So do you have any thoughts for that for people who are encountering this term or want to perhaps read more about it?
I mean, I think it's intentionally a nebulous term, right? So, we could ask, why do you like the Renaissance films more than, say, Robin Hood or The Rescuers or Fox and the Hound, films which have a pretty robust fandom, who would reject the idea that they're Dark Ages films, right? One of the things that we can certainly see becoming more of a dominant during the Renaissance is a stronger investment in a kind of goal-oriented protagonist three-act structure, right? Robin Hood is a more episodic approach to storytelling than, say, The Little Mermaid, where she's essentially on a quest. Obviously, music is key here as well, both the strength of the music being written and how it's being employed. And then, another area where you potentially get into very touchy terrain, and I imagine that you and Chris might throw hands on this, is right, both the use of xerography in the 60s and 70s, a kind of a sketchy like animation style that many people have noted, right? That we see in 101 Dalmatians, that we see in Oliver and Company, the use of sequences over again, kind of mapping new characters onto them, and whether or not that is actually a marker of quality, I think is up for debate, but it's certainly something that I think people lean into when they talk about, a return to Disney animation of the classical period is also a return to full animation. But of course, how we use that term, can be very divisive, right? So I think that, the quality of the animation, the use of music, the quality of the storytelling are factors that are often used to argue that there are, in fact, these three periods. But one of the things I would immediately push against is that, the team that worked on Beauty and the Beast was not the same team that worked on Little Mermaid. Some people came over into that film, but some people didn't. And you can look at the press coverage during that period where they're saying, Belle is not some little teenager in a clam bra, seeking love, right? She's a more mature woman, right? So they're actually throwing shade at their colleagues who did Mermaid 2 years earlier. And that's why, when scholars write about these films and they give D Disney agency, my immediate question is, who is the person at Disney that you're pointing to here, right? Because, we can't necessarily lump Mermaid and Beauty as easily together because there were different voices and different stakeholders and different production cultures on those films. And then, of course, the film split later on, where part of the team is working on Pocahontas and part of the team is working on the Lion King, and really it's the A squad working on Pocahontas because the studio thought the Lion King was just like a little side venture, right? And Disney's made this mistake before, right? Dumbo was seen as a side venture that did really well. So I mean, even the team splitting, right, showed that the production culture is far more complicated than.
It's funny because on the Beauty and the Beast episode, we talked about kind of disentangling some of the assumptions around the Renaissance and the presumptions that it is this neat, how handy that it's a 10-year period, and all the little the bits that go into making the Renaissance quite useful for Disney as a company. And certainly there are different ways, as you say, artistic styles and personnel. And I think some of the assumptions around the Renaissance is that it's like the Fried unit of the 50s, where the same people are just moving from production to production, and there's that stability of workforce. And actually, from what you're saying, that doesn't kind of seem to be the case. And also, I don't know whether you have anything to say about the sort of, it certainly feels like the first 5 years of the Renaissance are very different to the second 5 years, and that pivot of Pocahontas into Hunchback and then Hercules and Mulan, that they seem very different films to the first five, and it just, or the first 5 years. So it just feels like a lot of that's also, it seems that's where the curiosity lies, that it's presumed as this homogenous thing when actually, depending on who you ask, just as you said at the beginning, it's a lot more kind of
Yeah, I
fractured
mean,
than that.
and one of the things I say when people have, I've made that argument in private to folks, and one of the things we've often so noted in that is someone has said, "Well, yeah, you were born in '84. Of course, you think, Mermaid and Beauty were better than Mulan and Hercules." But for me, Mulan and Hercules were my jam, and you know what I mean? Like, so I think sometimes it's a generational thing in terms of how we determine quality in the Renaissance, right? Like what films matter. As dispassionate historians, we can certainly note the way the musical works, right? What Howard Ashman and Alan Menken are doing with the musical in Mermaid and Beauty, and I guess half of Aladdin is different than what Alan is doing on Hercules, or to a certain degree, what he's doing on Hunchback. And then I would say films like Tarzan are clearly outliers in terms of approaching the musical quite differently, right? That kind of pop sensibility that Phil Collins brings in, or Elton John brings in The Lion King. I mean, there's different modes of musical storytelling there for sure. And then also the source material, right? Whether you're using fairy tales, or you're using myth, or you're using American history very, very loosely, and how that tied into both corporate ventures, right? Because the Pocahontas Project is tied into an attempt to build a park in Virginia that goes belly up, and all the cultural politics around that. You know, the company recuperating from the blowback to Aladdin from the Arab American community, and thinking about multiculturalism,
yeah.
Right? So, you know, we haven't even really talked about the way that you can map the Disney Renaissance onto a period in thinking about diversity and inclusion that's very much evocative of a multiculturalist approach, right? That eventually yields to more of a diversity and inclusion approach, right? But comes out of an equal opportunity approach in the U.S. And I feel like scholars like Michelle Anya Ajabag are pointing us in that direction, right? To kind of think through the cultural politics here, right? But like, there's no Mulan, there's no Pocahontas without a growing concern about representation and growing pressure from those communities to like fix the way you've treated us. That being said, of course, that's not to say they got it right. But I mean, you know, that's a huge dimension of what's happening in the Renaissance. That as much as Disney wants to tell us that these are timeless films, they're very much products of the 90s in that way.
Yeah.
I think our time's about out, but to ask the final question or to also just mention the issue of kind of how this all plays out in terms of reception and things like that. One of the things that always strikes me, and I haven't done any rigorous scholarly analysis of this, but just strikes me anecdotally talking to people, is that Disney is a very, for various reasons, one, because of the animation, it's not so easy to know which one's from the 40s, which one's from the 50s, which one's the 60s, unless you know the technology really well, partially because they're not sequels, a lot of them. It's actually a lot easier for people to mix up and to ahistoricize their Disney viewership as fans of Disney than it is if you were a fan of, say, musicals, if you're a fan of, say, James Cagney movies or, you know, whatever. That ages. It's different. I mean, I know a lot of people who, when I talk about Disney history with them, will not realize that Robin Hood wasn't made the same year as Little Mermaid, as Pocahontas, as Snow White, right? They just kind of clump them together. And we might, as historians, want to... Well, there are important reasons why we must historicize something. But what's interesting, therefore, is that quite a lot of scholarship assumes a certain corpus of Disney movies that are the most impactful, that actually doesn't have any... There's no evidence for this on the ground. You know, the Disney Renaissance movies are the ones we talk about the most. The classical Disney ones are the ones we talk about the most, and we think we should do it because they're the most watched, they're the most viewed, they're the most culturally significant. Tell that to people that rewatch, you know, Oliver and Company and Robin Hood, and think it's maybe the same year as The Lion King, you know.
Yeah, and it's so intimately there's connected that as well. To the distribution history and exhibition history of Disney, right? Both people who would have seen Robin Hood in re-release, and then, of course, you know, the Disney Renaissance does not exist and work in the same way had it not been for home video. Right, home video is a huge game changer in Disney historiography.
Really. And to throw onto that, we really are already out of time now, but like to throw onto that, like then, and Disney always re-releases all its stuff all the time, so it's really difficult to kind of place your own memory. I mean, I'm pretty convinced the first movie I ever saw at the cinema was Little Mermaid, but that doesn't work. I'm not quite old enough for that to work, so. So I don't know when I saw it, but I probably saw it on a re-release sometime, right? So there's that problem as well. People go and see Snow White in the 60s and 70s and then go see Robin Hood, and it fuses together in their brain and doesn't create the chronological structure that we're all peddling over and over again. Chris, go on.
No, I was going to say, I was trying to think of, obviously we are out of time. This has been less of a footnote and more an annotated bibliography. An end note, if you will. In addition to the work of Michelle that you mentioned, who's very kindly written on the blog yourself, is there any other piece of work that you think, or that you kind of came across as part of your work for Disney Renaissance, that you point perhaps listeners to, students to, if they wanted to write and think about the Renaissance as an era of Disney?
There's so many pieces that I'm afraid I'm going to offend friends by not remembering. But I think, you know, I come from an industry studies background. And one of the things that's important for me and was important in my training was understanding Disney cannot just be done by looking at what's happening in film, right? So I think of like Sabrina Mittermeier's work on theme parks. I think about Jennifer Gillen's work on television and J.P. Talat's work on television. You know, and work that's starting to come out because I'm being asked to peer review it on merchandising and consumer products. We really need to think more holistically about Disney to appreciate what's happening in film. So those would be scholars who I would point to in terms of someone digging into this. And also, I think we also have to appreciate fans and journalists as historians in their own right. I mean, I was deeply indebted to podcasts and to journalistic accounts. I think particularly James Stewart's Disney War comes to mind. But, you know, I think if we're going to do Disney history and do it well, we have to realize that academics are not the only ones who are historicizing the company. Not to mention, of course, pushing it back against the received account that the Disney company approves.
Sure. Well, there we go.
Terrific. Well, Pete, thanks for sticking around and talking us through the Hollywood Renaissance. It's been a pleasure talking. We will now let you go. We promise this isn't a beast-like capture we're imposing upon you. But thanks so much for coming and talking to us. And yeah, thanks again.
It was wonderful to be here.
So you can send suggestions for future footnotes at fananimresearch, FANANIM research @gmail.com. Let us know and we'll get on it. Otherwise, we'll see you next time.
Bye.